Chair. Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Structured Negotiation, a Tool for Disability Rights. Currently at this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. Should anyone require assistance at any time during the conference, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. Also, as a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I'd now like to turn the call over to your host, Peter Berg. Sir, you may begin.
All right. Thank you very much, Dilem, and welcome everyone to the March ADA audio conference session. The ADA audio conference series is a project of the ADA National Network. The National Network is your leader in providing information on the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. You can locate the regional ADA center that covers your state by visiting adapa.org. For those of you who are participating through the webinar platform today, you are encouraged to submit questions while Lainey is doing her presentation. And we have time set aside at the end of the session to take as many questions as possible. As Dilem had said, today's session, Structured Negotiations, a tool for Disability Rights. Our speaker today is Lainey Feingold. You can find Lainey's information about Lainey on the by going to the speaker link on ada-audio.org. That is where you will find the bio for the speakers that present in the audio conference series. So at this time, I would like to welcome and turn it over to Lainey.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you to the participants, and thanks to the ADA National Network for having me. On my title slide, I have my website address, which is lflegal.com, and I also have my Twitter account, which is at LF Legal. I'm a big believer in Twitter as a tool for creating community, especially around disability rights and accessibility. So if you're on Twitter and we're not connected, I invite you to connect me. So just real quick, a little bit about me. As I said, my website is lflegal.com, and I put up here a couple of key things that I try to keep current on the website about both structured negotiation and digital accessibility. My specialty is digital access. I've been working with the blind community since 1994 on accessibility issues around web and mobile, APMs. We'll talk about that in a minute. I do updates on my website. There's a high-level nav bar, and I include updates not just from my work, but from litigation, administrative complaints, disability rights lawyers all over the country. So if you're interested in digital accessibility, you can check out the updates tab. I also have all the agreements that my colleagues and clients and I have worked on under the agreements tab, as well as press releases. I do have an email list under contact, which you're welcome to sign up for. And I also have a book, and the book is called Structured Negotiation, A Winning Alternative to Lawsuits. That's what we're going to be talking about today. The book's available through Amazon and the American Bar Association, who's the publisher. It's on Bookshare for people who are part of the Bookshare library who have print disabilities. It finally has a Kindle version up on Amazon. So that's a little bit about me, and you'll learn more about me as we move forward. So I'm going to advance a slide, except, here we go. So what is structured negotiation? Sorry, I'm going to get used to the platform for a second. Okay, what is structured negotiation? I have this illustrated with a win-win handshake because structured negotiation is a win-win alternative to lawsuits. Like I said, I've been working in this way for 20-plus years, and structured negotiation has a 20-plus year track record of resolving complex disability rights cases without lawsuits. It's cost-effective, and it's relationship-building, which is why I really like the handshake the handshake symbol. I call structured negotiation a tool in the advocate's toolbox because it is just one of the ways that the law has been really effective in advancing disability rights in the United States. You know, I've been successful not doing lawsuits, but I really like to say at the top of every presentation that lawsuits have really played a critical role in advancing disability rights. We're in a dangerous political time where there are threats to the right to file lawsuits. So I always like to start with the toolbox. It's a red toolbox. It's full of tools like hammers and wrenches and screwdrivers to show that there's a lot of different ways to use the law in advancing disability rights. Structured negotiation is one of them. I like structured negotiation because of the next slide, which is a picture of this gigantic hammer, which is part of a hardware store on Haight Street in San Francisco, because I like the saying, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When you think that an adversarial litigation process is the only way to enforce a claim, then you're going to look to a lawsuit. So the point of this session is to explain to you how structured negotiation has been used in the past and how you can use it, whether you're a lawyer or an advocate or a consultant. I see many of my friends on this list, and so I know you come from a variety of backgrounds, to give you the tools so you'll be able to evaluate different claims and decide whether structured negotiation would be a good fit. So we're going to start off by just a basic overview. Why is this thing called structured negotiation? Why structured? So when you file a court case, as people know, there's a structure. There are court rules. You file a complaint, and within a certain amount of time, whoever you're suing has to answer that complaint. And there's rules about all these things, how to exchange information. Well, in structured negotiation, we too have a structure. And the process begins with an opening letter. Again, we're going to talk about all these things throughout the next hour. But just as an overview, we start with an opening letter that's an invitation to participate in the process. We have ground rules. We share information in a collaborative way that's not governed by court rules and allows people to form relationships with each other. There's expertise, just like in a lawsuit. People hire experts. In structured negotiation, we use experts, but in a collaborative way where expertise can really help all the parties reach a goal to resolve disability rights or other claims. Especially in disability rights, as we'll talk about in a minute, client expertise, the expertise of disabled people is so important. Often in a lawsuit, that expertise can get lost. In structured negotiation, we use expertise in a different way. The goal of a structured negotiation is to have a written settlement agreement where the issue is resolved. We monitor that settlement agreement. We have a media strategy, and we have a mindset. Structured negotiation depends on having a collaborative mindset. We're going to talk a little bit more later about what that means. But we called this process, we named it back in the 90s after we had had our early successes, and we called it structured negotiation because we wanted to make sure we were saying this is not some weak cousin of litigation, or we didn't want to call it pre-litigation negotiation as if litigation was the real thing and pre-litigation was some sort of not the real thing, but this is an alternative path. It's an alternative structure to resolving claims. So what kind of cases has the process been successful with? We started with talking ATM. Structured negotiation began in the early to mid-90s, when the blind community individuals came to us, myself as a lawyer, I was at the Disability Rights Education Defense Fund, my colleague Linda Dardarian, who I've done most of my cases with. Blind people started coming to us and saying the ADA has been around for 4 or 5 years and there's still not a single ATM in the country that we can use. So we started this whole process in response to that community need for ATMs that were accessible to blind people, so blind people would not have to share their PIN or talk to strangers about what was on an ATM screen. And we were in California, we were focused on three California banks, Bank America, Citibank, and Wells Fargo. We had a good lawsuit. We had a good lawsuit that could have been filed. There were no accessible ATMs. The Americans with Disabilities Act protected the rights to effective communication and the use of this technology. But we were concerned about, you know, do we want to make bad law at the beginning of the ADA? And what if we got a judge who didn't understand technology or didn't think blind people should use the technology? And all these things, as I describe in the book, how we came to the decision early on, let's try writing. Let's try writing a letter to these banks and see if they'll talk to us. And much to our surprise, they did. All three banks talked to us, hired lawyers. We got into a process of negotiation. We didn't call it structured negotiation at the time because we didn't know we had a structure. We didn't know we had a thing. But what happened is those cases were successful. And by the late 90s, we had the first settlement agreements with Bank America, Wells Fargo, and Citibank on talking ATMs. And towards the end of those negotiations, our clients started coming to us and saying, well, it's really great you're doing talking ATMs, but there's this new thing called online banking. And if we don't have independent access to online banking, we're not going to have independent access to our finances. So because structured negotiation, which as I said, wasn't named at the time, but because we're in relationship with these banks, we were able to say, hey, you know, there's a new issue. And we didn't have to go to a judge, and we didn't have to go to a court filing, and we didn't have to go through procedures. But we were able to say, you know, we better figure out this web accessibility issue. And Bank America became the first bank, the first organization actually in the country to sign a web accessibility agreement using the international standards, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. It was 1.0 at the time. And out of that, we got involved with doing structured negotiation around websites, mobile applications. We have done structured negotiations for talking prescription labels, accessible pedestrian signals, audio description in movies, hospitals. And these are just some of the cases that this process has been successful for. And the book is full of stories of the cases, not just, you know, cases shorthand really for, when I say cases, we're really talking about disabled people's claims under federal civil rights laws for access. So the book is full of stories like that about the kinds of cases that structured negotiation has been successful with. Process has been used for injunctive relief, getting fixes. As I said, all the successful cases ended in settlement agreements. We are able to get money using this process, both for payment when it's allowed by state or federal law to the individuals, as well as for attorney's fees. So those are some of the kinds of cases that we've done with structured negotiation. What kinds of companies? Just really quick overview, and again, a lot of these stories are in the book, but I have a slide to show the companies that we've worked with just to emphasize that some of the biggest organizations in the U.S. have found this process to be effective. We've done work with CVS Pharmacy, with Major League Baseball, Weight Watchers, as I said, Bank of America. We started, as I said, in 2000 with the first web agreement. Most recently, we did an agreement with Bank of America on their mortgage information. Bank has been a really great partner in structured negotiation, really a leader in digital access. I have the logo on here. This slide has logos of the companies that I'm mentioning. Anthem Blue Cross, we did a deal, it was called WellPoint at the time, with a company that owns Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shields in various states on accessible healthcare information. You know, we started with accessible finance information, I think in large part because accessibility when it comes to finance really has to do with privacy and the rights of disabled people to independently and privately, confidentially access information. Same is true in healthcare. So this, and these companies I have up here are shorthand. We've done not just Anthem, but Caremark and Humana, other healthcare companies. Linda Dardarian did structured negotiations with Sutter and with Kaiser. So those are some of the kinds of companies the process has worked with. Process has also been successful with government agencies. We did an agreement with San Francisco about accessible pedestrian signals. Amy Robertson and Tim Fox did an agreement in Denver with structured negotiation on curb ramp accessibility. I have a picture of buses here because I work with Disability Rights Texas on a structured negotiation on the website for the Houston Transit Agency. So the process has proved effective for government agencies as well as private companies. This slide basically talks about the number of agreements. I've done now about 75 agreements or about 20 on talking ATMs. We've done 20 or more on web and mobile, alternative formats, tactile point of sale devices so blind people can independently enter their PIN, healthcare companies. We've done 6 talking prescription label cases so blind people know what's in their medication, and 1 audible prescription information. I'm going to skip a few of these just so we can stay on track time-wise. The agreements have all included training of employees. When you have a structured negotiation agreement, we're in relationship with a company, so we're really able to see what do they need, and training, whether you do a lawsuit or a structured negotiation or you're an advocate working without lawyers, training of staff is so important in disability rights cases. And in our structured negotiation agreements, we've worked on training customer service people, web and mobile developers, and web and mobile designers. And the last slide's a question mark, like what is structured negotiation going to bring in the future? I am hoping for my readers to let me know. I wrote the book. It's a roadmap through the process, step by step, so people can use it in different fields and in different types of disability rights cases. And it's full of stories, and I'm hoping that people who listen to me talk and read the book will let me know how they're using it. So how does the process start? Like I said, there's a structure. In the beginning of the structure is always about clients. In disability rights, it's always about disabled people. What are the claims? This is a process that is used to resolve legal claims. Several people have told me that there's certain tools that we're using that are useful even without a legal claim, like how to have a meeting we're going to talk about, how to write a letter, whether or not you have a lawyer that's going to engage the person you're writing to want to work with you instead of wanting to fight you. So that's where it all starts with disabled people and what their legal claims are and what they're hoping to get out of a legal process. And for those of you on this call not involved in disability rights, same holds true no matter what field of law you're in. So the first thing is the opening letter. This might be, I don't want to say it's the hardest part, but it might be one of the hardest parts. I got a call from a friend about a month ago. He's like, I really want to do structured negotiation. I can't be nice in the opening letter. I said, you can. You can do it. The opening letter needs to strike the balance between seriousness. These are, in the work I do, we're talking about federal civil rights laws, and I don't want to say kindness, that's going a little too far, but reasonableness. And yes, this is a serious matter, but we want to work on it with you in a collaborative way, and that depends on having language and tone that's invitational and not aggressive. It has to do with describing the legal claim calmly. I write in the book about how I don't, you know, oftentimes in a traditional demand letter you might say, you have discriminated against my client. While that's true, it may not be the best language to engage someone to want to work with you. Yes, we talk about discrimination when we talk about the claims, but we try to present everything in a very straightforward manner. And perhaps the hardest part of this for traditional lawyers is we always try to say something positive about the company in the opening letter or the government agency. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I did a structured negotiation with Charles Schwab about their website on behalf of a blind woman here in the Bay Area of San Francisco. And she was an options trader and a devotee, really, of this website. And like happens all too often, the company made a change in the site. She was no longer able to use it. Charles Schwab went on to be a great negotiating partner, completely committed to accessibility long after the agreement expired. But when we first wrote to them, you know, we didn't know. We knew there was a violation. But I spent time on their website, which I really advise doing before a letter is written. And I found that they had actually been very generous financially to disability groups. They have a social, not social justice, what do they call that? Social, you know, that term where corporations try to do good in the community. And they were bragging about their donations to the disability community. And I put that in the letter, and I thanked them for it. And I said, you know, it's really great that you've done this, and it's been important. And to be consistent with that philosophy of your company, you really need to work with us to resolve this legal claim. So that's just one example. Many of the organizations we've had to write structured negotiation letter to are good on customer service. I do a lot of work on technology and web accessibility. And say the point of sale devices, we did cases with Target and with CVS. These are Safeway. These are companies, Walmart. Walmart's participated in two structured negotiations. And many of these companies have good customer service, even though our clients weren't able to get high enough up to get the technology changed without getting a lawyer involved. So these are the kinds of things that we try to put in the opening letter. And lastly, most importantly, is building trust. Trust, like I write in the book, trust is the currency of structured negotiation. And it starts in the beginning. How do you establish trust on a piece of paper when you're writing to people you don't know? One of the things that we do is we always put in names of other lawyers, other companies who know us, who've worked with us, who know our clients, to say, you know, call them and see if we're trustworthy. You may not know us, but call them. I'm hoping that this book will help establish trust for the process, and people can say, look, here's a book you can read about other companies and other government agencies that have been in this process and have resolved claims. We also try to share information for that, you know, in a litigated case, you kind of have to save your best facts for later because, you know, smoking gun or gotcha. But we did a deal with American Express about their Braille statements, and our blind client had discovered that even though American Express wasn't doing Braille statements in the United States, they were doing them in Canada. And in a lawsuit, that would have been a really good fact to hold on to. That would have been a really good fact to hold on to and tell a judge later, but we don't have a judge. And so therefore, we didn't have a judge, and we wanted to establish trust. And so we put right in the letter, you know, you're doing Braille statements in Canada. You should be able to do them here in the United States. And we also gave the name of the vendor, the Canadian vendor, because you know what? American Express was a big company, and the people we're writing to may not have known. So that's just one example of how we try to establish trust. American Express went on. We ended up with a great settlement agreement with them, and we got the Braille statements, and they became great negotiation partners. I see a note here that says, are you on wireless internet? I'm not sure that's for me, but if it is, I'm not on wireless internet, so let me know if there's any problem with the audio.
Nope, the audio's fine, Lenny.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so the basic thing about the opening letter, which we call the opening letter, is don't demand. I have this, like, angry-looking white guy with a hat banging his fist on a table. Instead of demand, invite. The idea of the opening letter is to invite participation in a process, not to insist on a solution within a specific amount of time. The reason for that, in the cases I work on, there's often complexities and solutions can't be found, especially with big organizations, but even small organizations. Very hard to get anything done in 30 days. But lawyers tend to say, you know, fix this within 30 days or else we're going to have to sue you. So the idea of the opening letter is different, and we call it the opening letter even if the person you're writing to doesn't know that you're calling it an opening letter as compared to a demand letter. You know. And your clients know. And for the people with disabilities listening on this call, you know that this is something different than an insistence. And that helps the participants understand what we're going for in collaboration, whether, you know, whether or not the company knows, you know, Walmart, do they care whether I call it a demand letter or an opening letter? I'm not really sure. And I write about it in this book, but it matters to me as I write the letter, as I communicate with the person I'm hoping to negotiate with, that I'm thinking of it as an invitation and not as a demand. So you send the letter, and what happens next? You have to be patient and proactive. I have a very cute picture of a cute girl looking out a window waiting, because waiting is not something that lawyers are typically good at. Nor is being patient. I actually have a whole section of the book on patience. We're going to talk about that in a couple minutes. But it's the last chapter because the editors and I were afraid if we put patience at the beginning of this book, lawyers are not going to get past page one. But in many ways, patience is page one when it comes to structured negotiation. Because when you file a complaint, you know that the company or whoever you sued has to respond within a certain amount of time or else you're going to be in violation of some court rule and you're going to be able to go to some magistrate or some judge and get that person in trouble. Not so here. Here we send the letter, and oftentimes in an audience I get questions, well, why do they respond or how do you make them respond? But the truth, you know, the truth is it happens. People, you write a certain kind of letter and you get a certain kind of response. However, it doesn't mean you sit around until you get the response. You have to make sure the letter gets into the right hands. And one good thing about writing a book is that it allowed me to kind of look at 20 years, and I think I've done, I don't know, 60, 75 cases in this process, and I was able to see what sort of patterns emerged. And I realized that this period of waiting for the response requires, like I said, patience and also trust and confidence that this process is going to work. We put a date to respond in the letter. About a week before that date, I call up, try to find the person I sent the letter to. Did it get in the right hands? Sometimes no, for all the best laid reasons. And in the book, I kind of spell out what some of those stories have been. But we get the letter in the right hands, and we are patient, and then what happens? Then we get some sort of response. In addition to being patient, we have to be persistent. I was speaking about the book and structured negotiation and digital accessibility law up in Toronto during the hearings where Elizabeth Warren was shut down, and I changed my persistent slide with a picture of her and the hashtag #ShePersisted. And I said to the Canadians who were so supportive of our situation here in the United States, you know, if Elizabeth Warren can be persistent, and we have to be persistent in our resistance right now in the United States, certainly we can be persistent while we're waiting for response to an opening letter and not just throw in the towel because it doesn't come, you know, on the date we expected it. Eventually we get a response. And another thing I realized in writing the book that I hadn't really known is that evaluating the response is also a tricky time. And I have these two pictures on this slide. One is a woman with her arms wide open to the ocean. She's a wheelchair rider. And it says, don't expect this. Don't expect that your letter, no matter how nice you were, no matter how many positive things you found to say, don't expect that you're going to be greeted with open arms, because it's still a legal complaint. And it's still, it's not a demand, but explains that the legal right is to get the problem fixed, is to get paid in certain circumstances for the lawyers, is to get paid in certain circumstances for the client. So no one is going to rush and say, oh, gee whiz, we're so glad you sent us a structured negotiation opening letter. But you don't need open arms. What you need is the next picture with a little crack in the door, a little bit of opening. Look for this. So, for example, when we wrote to Major League Baseball, who Major League Baseball has been a great negotiating partner. One of the structured negotiation success stories, I tell the whole story in the book, and it might never have happened because when we first wrote to Major League Baseball, the lawyer called and he said, we need a week delay. I mean, we need an extra week to respond. So, of course, we said yes. The week came, the week went, and we didn't get a response from the guy. And we're thinking, like, really? We call, but we didn't throw in the towel. We had patience. We had persistence. We called the lawyer, and he was like, I wrote to you. I don't know what happened. I sent him FedEx. Sure enough, the letter got lost. Eventually, we got the letter. And the first three paragraphs, like most of the letters we get, were, we didn't do anything wrong, you know, our websites are fine, or our websites aren't required to be accessible, or this or that or the other thing. But buried in that letter was still, we'd like the opportunity to meet with, you know, we like, welcome, I have the exact language in the book, but we're willing to sit down with you and your clients to discuss the issues. That is all you need. And I went over all the letters that we had gotten in responses to all our letters, and so many times that was what we got in response, a whole bunch of no's and one little yes. So you look for that yes, you evaluate the response, and you call back, take a deep breath, you don't pay attention to all the no's, and you pay attention to the desire of the other side to sit down and talk with you. So you get the response, what comes next? Well, I have a slide in here with yes, no, because like a road sign with yes off to the left and no off to the right, because there's many junctures in structured negotiation where it would be very easy to say, no, this is not going to work. No, we better have a judge. And, you know, sometimes you may decide, clients and lawyers may decide together, you know, this isn't going to work. And we have had situations, and I write about that in the book. But mostly, the vast, vast majority of times in the stories that I share in the book were when you get the evaluation, you stick with it further, and you take it to the next stage, which is figuring out the ground rules. So in structured negotiation, we don't have court rules, and we don't have civil procedure. So we have to establish ground rules. In the book, I have a sample ground rules document. Sometimes the beginning of the case is a month, 2 months, more than 2 months, working out the ground rules. And this is a place where relationships start to form. The ground rules have to protect the client's rights, disabled people's rights, while they're in the process. Because if anybody's going to lose anything by being in this process, we shouldn't be in it. We should be in court. So the ground rules identify who's part of the negotiation. They list the topics for negotiation. But as I say in the book, it's the topics, not that necessarily the details of the end result. So, for example, on talking prescription labels, where we've done agreements with CVS and Walgreens and Rite Aid and other pharmacy chains and healthcare providers, the topic is improving accessibility of prescription label information. So we know who the vendors are and what time frame we want the talking labels to be provided. We have ideas of all those things, but they don't have to be decided right at the outset. We just have to have clarity that everyone's on the same page about what we're going to be talking about. We toll the statute of limitations, which means, for those of you who aren't lawyers on the call, nobody's penalized by not going to court, because when you have a legal claim, you have to go to court by a certain time. And if we're in negotiation, we don't want that time to tick by and then our clients to be out of luck if the negotiations don't work out. So there's a tolling agreement. There's confidentiality of the negotiation, but not of the process. Oftentimes, companies or government agencies will come to us and say, oh, we want the whole thing to be confidential. We don't want anyone to know we're talking to you. And we really try to discourage that, because when people know, then it helps the companies or the organizations avoid lawsuits, for one thing. But two, it tells the community, hey, you know, there's a structured negotiation on this issue. I know that the National Federation of the Blind did a structured negotiation with Lyft, the ride-sharing service, and they put out a statement together with the clients and the lawyers saying, we're in structured negotiation on this topic, because they wanted the community to know, if you have a problem, tell the people who are working on the structured negotiation. We have to protect attorney's fees in the ground rules document, because there's certain case law out there that says you can't get attorney's fees in an ADA case if you don't have a court order. But of course, we're not getting a court order, so we have to make sure that the ground rules are very clear that the attorney's fees will work just as if a lawsuit had been filed, although of course the attorney's fees in a structured negotiation are far less, because as we'll see, there's far less of the procedural, well, there's no real procedural wrangling, and the, all the parts of it are much more cost effective. The whole process is much more cost effective. And then an end date in the ground rules. So there's different ways to do it, and I lay it out in the book. You can say, okay, we're going to negotiate for 1 year, and then the structured negotiation is called off. I personally don't like putting an end date in, because you never know what's going to happen. You need to stay persistent. You need to stay on top of it, but you don't necessarily need to say a year ahead of time when the negotiation will be over. So when you get the ground rules, you give them to the other, you know, you write the ground rules, everybody discusses the ground rules, and then, of course, there are objections to the ground rules. And I like this picture of this little girl looking at her broccoli, and like she doesn't want to eat the broccoli, even though the broccoli is good for her. And structured negotiation is a good way to resolve claims, and there really should be no objections to a government agency or a company when approached in this process, because it's cost effective, it's efficient, it allows people to maintain control, whereas in a lawsuit you give it over and a judge could do something that neither side likes. So there's many, many good reasons, but there's often objections. So this is another juncture where I might have a slide next that says yes or no. Another juncture where it could be easy to throw in the towel. Might take a long time to get the ground rules, but again, it's about trust. It's about sharing successes of the process. Again, I hope the book will be useful in that way. There's often concern at the early stage about money. How much is this going to cost? So there's a lot of conversation that has to occur that's not really about the issue that your claim is. You know, it's not about the curb ramp that's not there or the website that's not accessible, but it's really important to keep and form a good relationship while working on the ground rules, because that really is the foundation for moving forward. So eventually in the process, you get the ground rules signed. You either do or you don't. In almost every case I've done, we've had the ground rules signed. If the ground rules aren't signed, then you are faced with the question, do I proceed with structured negotiation or do I go to court for protection? I would say in most cases you would want to choose a court route. If someone won't sign ground rules, it seems unlikely that they would end up working in good faith and collaboration on the actual issue at hand. So assuming you get the ground rules signed, the next thing that you're going to work on, just like you would in a court case, is you have to build a shared understanding. Now, the way that works in a lawsuit is you have to take depositions and write questions or, you know, have site visits, all of which are tightly regulated by court rules and civil procedure and other things that take a lot of time, cost a lot of money, and don't necessarily build shared understanding that really helps solve a problem. So in structured negotiation, we build shared understanding in three different ways. One is we exchange written information. And again, this is informal. Oftentimes, you know, we could even do it by an email or send a list of questions. And people often in the live audience ask me, but how? Why do they answer? Why do you get any information? And the truth is, I know this sounds kind of Pollyannish, but when you are in this process, and by the time you're exchanging information, you sign ground rules, you're on the same page that there is a legal claim that needs to be resolved, and we rarely have pushback because we're asking for information that we need, and we're willing to be patient in terms of potential responses. So, for example, someone could say we ask, we did a case with Weight Watchers on their accessible web and mobile, and we needed to know what kind of information do you give members, and what's on the website, and what's, you know, in web cases, in mobile app cases, you want to know, do you use a vendor, and who the vendor is, and there's lots of questions that you need information for. And maybe the company wants to give you 75% of what you want, but not 100%. And we're able to say in the process, okay, give us a 75, and let's see if we need any more. And if we need more, we're usually able to explain why, and we've built the trust all along, and we find that the information is shared. So we do that by exchanging written information, and then probably the best part are the structured negotiation meetings. I tell a lot of stories in the book about the meetings because they're really the highlight. And I think in disability rights in specific, they're the highlight because the companies or the government agencies or the decision makers are getting to meet disabled people and form relationships with them. So, for example, I mentioned Charles Schwab and the blind investor. Instead of them having to take a deposition of the client and, you know, try to trick her, or even not try to trick her, just try to get information in the stilted way of a deposition, we had a meeting at Charles Schwab with their lawyers who were great and committed to the issue throughout. They brought their web people, their training people. We set up a screen. The blind woman turned on her. She used a computer that had software installed to speak the screen out loud, as well as a braille display, which I have a picture of here on the slide, which is a mechanical device that will read content, refreshable braille display, constantly changing. And that meeting was really all it took, because people could build the shared understanding. Oh yeah, they could see this, like, power user was not able to use the site because of certain problems. And I interviewed as I wrote the book, I interviewed as many of the lawyers and companies that would talk to me, as well as most, if not all, of the clients and organizational reps that have participated in structured negotiation. And so many of the company people said, you know, show, not tell. And by meeting the clients early on with the talking ATMs, you know, banks saw Braille on ATMs were going to do the trick for ADA compliance. But blind people knew that Braille couldn't help an interactive machine be accessible. The only way to make an ATM accessible is by making it talk. So we could have written, you know, a 100-page brief or hired experts. Instead, we had meetings of bankers could see blind people using ATMs without talking. And, like, literally you could see the light bulbs go off. So the structured negotiation meetings are really the highlight. Now, you know, honestly, and as I say in the book, there are some cases that have been very lawyer-driven, and we don't have these meetings for whatever reason. But the best cases, Major League Baseball, for example, that structured negotiation was so successful because Major League Baseball got to know our clients as blind baseball fans. And too often when you go into an adversarial system, people have to take on the roles that the system gives them, plaintiff, defendant, experts. And there's a lot of baggage with all those roles. Structured negotiation I'm sure the companies and the organizations never lose sight of the fact that people have legal claims, but still they're getting to form a relationship with the person instead of plaintiff, which is a term we don't even use because it's so loaded. Blind baseball fan, you know, blind investor, wheelchair rider who needs access to a hospital, things that break through the roles and allow relationships to be established and allow empathy to be created on both sides. When we're dealing with finance, there is legitimate concern on the finance side about security issues and breaches and all sorts of corporate things that are able to be explained when, you know, we might want something done by this date, and it really can't be done by that date. It has to be done by a different date, and the meetings allow the kind of conversation where people can really build shared understanding. So, like I say, I talk a lot about those meetings in the book, mostly because they were the most fun thing to write about. And the meetings, like I say, some have been very lawyer-driven, but in many, the lawyers can stay in the back seat, have the back seat of the car as the image, and relationships are possible. Again, the handshake. So that's how we build shared understanding. It basically works because people aren't trying to hide the ball, which I have a picture of a guy hiding a ball, playing that game where you hide the ball under three cups, and instead, they're sharing. Maybe this is a cheap, cute picture, little boy sharing the ice cream cone with a little girl, white boy, African-American girl sharing the ice cream cone, but sharing actually works, and that's what happens in the best of cases in this process, and that's why it works. So let's see. Okay, another piece of information sharing, experts. Expertise is very expensive in traditional litigation. And I quote a young lawyer in my book who said, it's so frustrating because I have great experts, but the other side doesn't listen to them because they're my experts. And expertise gets very polarized, and in structured negotiation, we try to have joint experts whenever possible. In the digital accessibility space, a lot of times expertise is needed, and we want the institutions we work with to have the best experts. We don't want to have to hold them for ourselves. We want the companies to be able to use them. So we often recommend two or three experts for the companies to use. Nobody likes to have expertise shoved down their throat, as one of my experts quoted in the book. So we always give a couple names so organizations can feel they have someone that fits with their corporate culture, because digital accessibility, for it to be accessible, for it to be effective and to stick, it's really a whole kind of a whole body experience. The whole organization from top to bottom has to understand accessibility and, you know, training and customer service and design, quality assurance, everything has to be touched with it. You need the experts to fit in with the corporate culture. So that's one good thing about structured negotiation expertise, and one that saves a lot of money. Another is that the clients can be experts. And I think I mentioned this earlier, that especially in disability rights, the expertise of disabled people is so important and is often lost. Not always, but often lost in litigation. And one of the best examples I have of that is our accessible pedestrian signal case with the City of San Francisco. And one of our clients, a representative of the California Council of the Blind, was like a national expert on accessible pedestrian signals. And he was also blind, and he was also someone who was serving as a claimant. But because the roles are softened in structured negotiation, he was able to share his expertise and everyone was able to benefit from it. Whereas in a litigation, it would be more like, oh, he's the client, we can't really trust him because, you know, he's in it for whatever reason. So the expertise, I have a whole chapter in the book on working with experts and how we've done it. And it's probably one of the biggest selling points of the process when, you know, early on trying to convince whoever you have a claim against, hey, this is a good process. It's going to save you a lot of money with how we deal with expertise. So once you have the shared information, then the next step is drafting the agreement. And in terms of, of course, every case is going to be different. It's going to depend on, you know, what the issues are. But there's a couple strategies that apply throughout. One is timing. When is it that you send a settlement agreement? If you're too early, people can get freaked out and you set yourself back. Or if you're too late, then people feel, oh, we might not need this settlement agreement. So the whole timing thing is very both tricky and a chance to be creative. Again, structured negotiation without specific time requirements. And this is also true in litigation. At some point, most all cases settle. You have to decide when you're going to write an agreement. But every step of this process has to be infused with the idea of cooperation and collaboration. So when we're deciding when to send an agreement, usually I call the other side and say, you know what, do you think this is a good time to start writing things down? And that way people aren't surprised, they're not taken aback, the lawyers don't have to, you know, explain to their clients why they got this document, but everyone's in agreement on, yeah, it makes sense to start writing things down. Or maybe you're just going to do a list of issues rather than specific language. So I talk a lot about that in the book, about how to get started on the actual written settlement agreement, which is very important. This is a structured process with a goal of a written binding agreement. Baby steps. Very important in structured negotiation, baby steps. When you write a book, you get to look at the whole landscape, and so many of the cases that I've worked on would not have been successful had we been unwilling to take small steps on the path. So, for example, talking ATMs, we wanted thousands. We eventually got thousands. We were thrilled when we got the first 10. Websites, mobile, when we work with Major League Baseball, we had like a 2-year process. In 1 year, we did the audio. One of the big issues in that case was blind people wanting to listen to baseball online. We got that 1 year. We got other things the next year. Audio description. We got one movie theater in one location before we got the whole country. So that idea of taking small steps, never losing sight, you know, eye on the prize, never losing sight of the big goal, but recognizing and appreciating small steps. And working around fear. I had to make a whole slide just for fear with a picture of this, like, white guy with his hands up going, ah, you know, he's afraid. When I do these talks in person, I carry around my fear monster, which is this plastic toy I got, because fear is such a big obstacle to get around in settling cases. Where you don't have a judge to fall back on and say, oh, you're wrong, you're right, do this. So, for example, especially in disability rights, I don't know, I'm going to be curious to see what kind of feedback I get about structured negotiation from lawyers in other fields and whether fear plays as big a role. But in disability rights and around blindness in particular, there is so much fear that structured negotiation has really helped break down. So, for example, in the accessible pedestrian signal cases, the city of San Francisco was truly afraid that if they had audible signals, blind people would accidentally go into the street at the wrong time. Now, we, of course, thought that was ridiculous because with the pure visual signal, blind people get no information. But nonetheless, there was an actual fear. Same with the prescription labels. There was a fear that the talking information would be misunderstood. One of the things about structured negotiation and patience and forming relationships and not assuming people are trying to screw you over, or not assuming people are just saying something to delay, but that their experiences are real to them, no matter what we think of them. So in all these cases, we had to work with these companies either through small steps or through actually meeting people to help them understand, like, okay, they might be afraid that blind people will be hit by a car, but that fear is not rational. That fear is not based in reality. We did the ATM cases. We had one of the banks say to us, blind people will get mugged at an ATM. They shouldn't use an ATM. that was a fear that was not only not grounded in reality, but it was very ableist for the sighted bankers to decide what was best and safe for the blind customer. But all these fears we were able to work out because we recognized them, we understood them as true for the person holding it, even though we didn't hold it, we were able to dismantle it, and we were able to draft around fears in certain circumstances. So, for example, we did a deal with the credit reporting agencies for free credit reports for blind people in accessible formats as well as online. And the credit reporting companies were very afraid that too many people would ask for it and it would like break their whole system. And so we had very detailed language, a certain number of people asked, and this would happen, that would happen, none of which came to fruition, but we were able to write language to give a comfort level of going forward without detracting in any way from what disabled people needed in the agreement. Same with the ATMs. We had so much language, if. You know, lawyers are masters of the what if. What if having a talking ATM breaks the whole system? You know, what if this, you know, wrecks the security? What if this happens? What if that happens? What if the law changes? What if the law doesn't change? So these are the kinds of factors that come into to drafting and recognizing that other people may be afraid, but we have to work with them if we want to get what we need from the structured negotiations. So money. Structured negotiations has been effective for money, and we've been able to get client damages. Many disability rights laws allow for disabled people to be paid for civil rights violations, as well as fee shifting, which means in most cases, people have to pay their own lawyers, but Congress has decided that in civil rights cases, when disabled people or black people or women are successful, then the other side pays their fees. We protect that in structured negotiations. I have a whole chapter in the book about negotiating about money because it's very easy to fall back into an adversarial mode once money comes up. We typically talk about money at the end after the solution to the problem has been resolved. And I think it was a Citibank lawyer I quote in the book, and he says, you know, if people are going to get adversarial, just talk about attorney's fees. And it's sure enough, people are going to get adversarial. But I have some strategies on how to avoid that, mostly by, you know, staying calm. But it has been a successful process. It has been a successful process for that. Media and monitoring, another part of the structure. What I want to say about media, which I think is first, let's see. Media? Yes, media strategies first. We don't do negative press releases in structured negotiation. And that's why the picture is of a newspaper that says good news. Because, and this I think was very interesting, when I was interviewing the company lawyers, many of them said getting a negative press release is worse than getting a lawsuit. And in structured negotiation, because we're trying to form relationship, we don't put out a press release at the beginning, which may be a good strategy in a lawsuit because it can get witnesses or class members. But in structured negotiation, we wait until we have something positive to report, and the press releases the timing piece is wait until the end. The appreciation piece is make sure the press releases are mostly announcing a new initiative. They're all in one place on my website. You can go under the topics tab, and you can look up press releases, structured negotiations, and you can just read a paragraph about every single one with a link to the full release, and you'll definitely see a pattern of appreciation, clients saying good things about the company. As time went on, the lawyers took a back seat. I think if you're a lawyer for a nonprofit, it's important to get the lawyer of the nonprofit's name out. But as a private lawyer, we found that if we put our names in or if we have a quote from us, it looks like it was an adversarial situation, and we don't need that, so we tend not to. Most of our settlement agreements include press releases, even though it's not required, but the people we've negotiated with see it as an advantage. So that's part of the structured negotiation strategy. In terms of monitoring, the monitoring strategies are, you know, as they would be in a settled case after a lawsuit was filed, but we don't have a judge to fall back on if something goes wrong. But after 20 years and all these agreements, I can honestly say that we haven't needed a judge to fall back on, because the same flexibility and relationship that has infused the whole structured negotiation infuses the monitoring period. So monitoring happens after a settlement, and, you know, in most of the cases that I've been involved with, the companies or the government agencies do what they're supposed to do. But sometimes, especially when you have a big situation like, you know, talking prescription labels in 7,000 stores or a website with thousands of pages, things can go wrong, and we've gone to dispute resolution, or we've chosen not to go to dispute resolution. Again, I talk about this in the book. If we see that a company is in violation of the agreement, I will say in almost every single case that I can think of right now, everyone, the company lawyers have agreed that there's a violation. It's not that there's an intentional violation. It's just that when you have a lot of people, a lot of customer service or whatever, things can go wrong. So we will say often to a company, hey, we have a problem. Do you think we should go to dispute resolution, which is always built into our agreements? Sometimes the company says, yeah, we need to elevate this. And sometimes the company says, you know what, if we put this in dispute resolution, we may have a harder time solving the problem. So again, it's flexibility, cooperation. We've had situations where we've had to extend agreements because the time we thought it was going to take to fix something was not enough time. Sometimes we've had to do a new case. Sometimes we've had to do individual cases when it's one of those, you know, affecting 7,000 store things. And throughout, we try to practice trust and collaboration and patience and all the elements that make structured negotiation effective. So that brings us to language and mindset, which, as I said, is the last chapter of the book, but something that is throughout structured negotiation. The first one is active patience. And to illustrate this, I have a picture of a surfer. His name is Derek Rebello, and he's a big wave surfer in Brazil. Well, he's an international surfer, but he's from Brazil, and he's blind. And I heard about him because I always talk about patience for years, even before I wrote the book, about the importance of patience in structured negotiations. And I use the adjective active patience because it's not just sitting around twiddling your thumbs. It's recognizing that giving someone time to understand the needed changes or get with whoever in the company is going to write the check, that takes patience. But you need to be active. The active part is follow-up emails and weekly phone calls and status reports. And while you're waiting, making sure things are actually happening. And this is a tool that it's critical for structured negotiation, but I've had people tell me that the part I wrote about patience in the book is really useful for many things. You know, I work a lot with accessibility people who are on teams who, you know, I met a guy at CSUN last week. He's in a big company with 37,000 employees. He is the only accessibility person, and he's holding down the entire fort of accessibility. And he really needs to be patient. It has nothing to do with law or structured negotiation. So when I do my slides, I like to have illustrations, and I try to have good slides. So I put the word out once, what would be a good image for patience? And someone wrote, what about a surfer? Because they have to wait for a wave. And I always try to, if I can, have a disability angle to my slide. So I just randomly looked up blind surfer and discovered Derek Rebello. There's actually a movie about him. And I like this because he can be patient out there in the middle of nowhere waiting for a wave. We can be patient and practice the kind of patience it takes to get the other side to come on board. So that's one of the mindsets. factors. Another one is trust. We've talked a lot about trust. At every stage, it's important to be trustworthy. Give people the benefit of the doubt. Not forever, not be taken advantage of. You know, there can be times where you say, okay, enough already. I've been too patient, and certainly I have fallen into that. But it's pretty rare to be too trustworthy, and it can break so easily. So at every stage, it's important, I think, structured negotiation. It's not just the structure of it, knowing how to write the letter, but having this attitude, having this mindset, not assuming people are, you know, lying to you or trying to screw you out of something. It matters to make the process work. Grounded optimism, like the glass half full. Optimism, I read about grounded optimism. I said that is a structured negotiation thing, because if you don't believe in this process, then it's too easy to throw in the towel and say we need a judge or we need a court or we need a magistrate. Let me just say quickly about mediation. We have used mediators in structured negotiation, and the process can dovetail very nicely with mediation. Mediation is a great process and a great dispute resolution tool. Too often now, it's used after people have already spent a lot of money and formed bad relationships with each other. And, you know, the beginning of the mediation has to be kind of undoing that. We've brought in mediators mostly when we've gotten stuck around money, but there's also situations where mediators have been brought in on the substance. And again, the process can be creative and flexible. And if you get stuck, you don't have to think that the only solution is a court case. It might be, but other processes as well. And that's why I say grounded optimism. The grounded part is knowing you're not just optimistic and just hold your breath, it's going to turn out right, but you're grounded in following the steps of structured negotiation, practicing the mindset that when you do those things, it is by and large, in most cases, in almost all the cases I've gotten the ground rules document signed, been successful. So optimism is another part of the mindset. So again, on language, this comes up in the opening letter as well as throughout. The word defendants, try not to use it, because defendants defend. And in this process, because we're not having to prove things to a judge or have motions or have briefing, we don't have to talk as much about past conduct. We're focused on future conduct. We don't want whoever we're writing to defend their inaccessible website or their lack of prescription labels or their mobile app that doesn't work for blind people or their videos that don't have captioning. We don't want defendants to defend, so we don't use the word. We don't want opposing counsel to oppose. And like I said, I want to be careful about the word discrimination, which was a hard part of the book to write because, of course, disability discrimination is a real thing and a critical thing and something that disabled people have fought against for generations and whose activism has gotten us the laws we have today. But still, given all that, I'm not sure how useful it is as a motivator to get people to do things. And so when you're in a collaborative process, you have to think carefully about the words you use. So that is the overview I wanted to give you all. Just really quick, and I want to leave time for questions, a few other points about why the process has worked. Dismantle assumptions. Don't show, don't tell. We talked about that. Create the shared understanding. And I have a picture of a rubber stamp that says, don't believe the Braille. This was a stamp that my friend Josh Mealy had made up in the 90s before I knew him. And he stamped it on ATMs because he was so frustrated as a grad student at Cal, UC Berkeley, that ATMs didn't talk and instead they had Braille. And he gave me this stamp when I finished the book as a present. And I like it because the bankers believed the Braille. They thought that was enough, like we said, and it wasn't, and we were able to show and not tell them. And in many, many cases, the process has allowed us to dismantle assumptions that people have about disabled people and about the issues that we worked on. So dismantling assumptions is a key part. Respecting small steps. Talked a little bit about this before. Interim measures, pilot programs. Have this illustrated with a Harry Potter picture. And in my live talks, I have a Harry Potter magic wand because we got Cinemark to install audio description equipment for one of our clients, a blind girl who was 10, who's wanted to see the opening of Harry Potter. And the company wasn't ready to do audio description nationally, but because we had the relationship with them, they were able to install it in the one theater for the Harry Potter opening. And we respected that. The girl wrote an email, and we sent it to the Cinemark, and the Cinemark president eventually became a real champion of audio description, and they've been a great company to work with, and it was all because we respected small steps. That's just one of many, many small step examples. Flexibility. I like this picture of a woman doing a yoga handstand, forearm stand on a computer. Tell a lot of stories in the book about how structured negotiation allows, you have to be flexible, but it allows for changed circumstances. We get a new client or somebody has a new issue. Because we're not in a strict process with court rules and judges, we've been able to add in new disability issues. When we work with Major League Baseball on their website, the App Store wasn't even open. While we're in negotiation with them, the App Store became open, mobile apps became a thing, accessibility of mobile apps became another thing. We were able to fold that into our negotiations with Major League Baseball and the blind baseball fans. So I think we should open up for questions as I show my bottom line. The bottom line of structured negotiation is more of this, which are three girls talking to each other, and less of this, which is a picture of conversation bubbles that say, no thanks, no, 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 no. And too often the litigation system gives people the opportunity to say no in a million different ways, to file a motion to throw a case out or argue that the plaintiff is the wrong person or didn't do the right thing. In structured negotiation, there's less opportunity to say no, so more people say yes. So I don't know if the questions, do we have any questions?
I'm going to ask Dilem to come back and give instructions for our participants on telephone at this time, please.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen on the phone, if you have a question at this time, please press star and 1. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
All right. Well, we'll wait to see if we have any questions there. I have some that have come in submitted beforehand. But I've got this one myself, which as the moderator gives me the flexibility to ask this question. So Lainey, if you could speak to, you know, big picture, you know, from you've been doing this for 20 years, and what has been your experience with regards to the companies when you contact them and raise the, you know, the issue of their non-compliance? I imagine at the beginning, you know, it was, you know, we didn't know when you know, first about ATMs. But what, you know, if you could talk about that experience as to why a business has been non-compliant, you know, ignorance of the law, you know, didn't care, or no one with a disability had ever contacted them about that particular issue.
I think I've experienced all those things. One of the ways in which I practice law is I really think it's important for disabled people or any plaintiff to see if they can solve the problem themselves. Like I always say, nobody wants to be in a lawsuit, either the person sued or the person bringing the suit. I mean, disabled people have lives to live and would rather not be having to do lawsuits whenever there's inaccessibility. So we do often hear, oh, we didn't know about this. Why didn't you tell us? And it's always important for me to be able to say, well, you know what? You weren't listening because you got this complaint or so-and-so talked to a store manager. And a lot of the cases, almost all the cases, start with poor customer service, honestly, in these kinds of circumstances. And there have been complaints. And disabled people have talked to store managers or have filled out a web form, and the complaint hasn't gone anywhere. So like I said, we hear all sorts of reasons not to do it at the beginning, and that's the picture where we're not looking for open arms. We're looking for a slim opening to have a conversation. And the more you can talk directly to people, the more you can help them understand, yeah, you have a real problem here, and it's a legal issue. I mean, I think at disability rights, one of the things we've all heard is, oh, well, this is, you know, we'll fix it or whatever. But no, these are, once it gets to this stage, you're talking about civil rights claims. And that's something that we often have to impress upon people in the early part of the relationship.
Very good. All right. We had a question from someone in the webinar room. And hold on, let me get this. Any suggestions in working with entities that insist on putting attorneys in the driver's seat versus the back seat?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like I say, sometimes we have done cases. Web somewhat lends itself to this because, you know, now there's a lot more awareness of web accessibility, and if we contact a company, they may not feel that they want to meet the clients. I mean, one of the things that I've learned, we had a case set up and we were going to have a meeting, the clients and the lawyers. And the lawyer for the company called us at the last minute, I think I tell the story in the book, and said, we don't want to meet. And I'm like, why? What happened? Like, the clients were afraid to meet the plaintiffs. We don't call them plaintiffs, the claimants, because they had had bad experience. And a lot of times at the beginning, I have to say, you know, this isn't going to be an adversarial meeting where people are yelling at each other. Because when we have the structured negotiation meetings, there's two goals to every meeting. One is the particular goal, like we might be talking about a particular web page or documents or what the customer service experience was. But in every single meeting, there's also the goal of establishing relationship. And so I think some of these companies, are, and especially ones that have outside lawyers, not even just outside lawyers, but, you know, some lawyers are like afraid to get to know the clients. And I think that's another example of a fear. Actually, I hadn't really thought about that, but I think that is a fear. And I'm often saying, you know what, when you're ready, I think it'd be really useful if, you know, your people could talk to my people, if your clients could talk to our clients. And when it's successful, it's really good because even inside the biggest corporations, and we've dealt with like the biggest companies in the United States, there's still people in charge of departments who want to get things right. And if you can get past the lawyers, oftentimes you're a lot better. On the other hand, sometimes you need the lawyers to help the companies or the government agencies explain, hey, you got a legal problem here. You have to get it fixed.
Right. All right. Before I check and see if we have any calls on the phone, we've got people submitting questions.
Okay, real quick, I have the slide up. I just want to say that the book, you can find out more information at lflegal.com/book. It's not just for lawyers. I think one of the reasons it took me 6 years is because I was trying to write a real, you know, straightforward roadmap full of stories. And like I said, I interviewed probably close to 75 people to write the book. And then while we're doing the questions and answers, I'm going to well, let me tell you, one slide, more resources on my website at lflegal.com in the topics tab, which is at the very, one of the high-level nav topics is called topics, has every article ever written on the website, including the settlement agreements, the press releases, as well as accessibility updates, things about talking prescription labels, the DOJ regulations. I've written a lot about delay and various federal regulations. I have a couple pieces on what the new administration, so-called administration, means to disability rights. So everything you can find under topics. In the about page, hashtag SN, there's interviews and podcasts. I was on public television, public radio about the book. So if you want to know more about structured negotiation, that's a good place to start. And then in the resources page, I have resources related to digital accessibility, captioning, description, digital accessibility consultants, usability resources. So that's a good place to go. And then while we're doing the questions and answers, I'll just put up the last slide about staying in touch, where I have my Twitter. Again, it's at LF Legal. The email list, actually, this is wrong. If you want to join my email list, it's lflegal.com/contact. You don't have to send me an email anymore. I have just a really easy form, lflegal.com/contact. The speaking page has the upcoming talks, and like I said, about #SN has the interviews. So I'll leave that up while we do the questions.
All right. Before we check on the phone, let me get to another one from the webinar room. Has this process been used with educational entities, public, private, K-12, post-secondary?
I have not used it with educational cases, but I think there's a lot of potential there. I think there's a lot of potential. Like I say, we did a case with American Cancer Society, and I think nonprofits and people, education institutes, government agencies who might have more concern about their budget are very ripe for this process. So I hope that structured negotiation will be used in the education setting going forward.
Okay. Dilem, do we have any questions on the telephone at this time?
Yes, sir. I do show we have a question from Peter Rice. Your question, sir.
Hi. My question is, have you ever used this in lieu of a class action lawsuit against, like, a large State Department, a State Department of Health and Human Services or anything like that?
I haven't used it against the State Department of Health and Human Services. Most of my cases can be looked at as in lieu of class actions, because even though we're representing just one or two individuals or one organization, we try to fix whatever we're working on for the entire company. So American Express, I mentioned, is a good example, or Major League Baseball, or the point-of-sale cases, talking prescription labels. We're getting the solution throughout the company, not just for the individuals, but I haven't had experience with the type of department that you're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
But I hope you will, and let me know what happens.
I will.
All right, another question from the platform. I think you gave an example, but this person is asking, can you give an example of a structured negotiation with a state or local government entity? And the person says the government entities usually have more reason to say no than private agencies. And then the question goes on, money is controlled at another level. So where does the negotiation start with a state or local government entity?
You have a lot of good questions in there. That's good. Yeah, I talk about in the book, with public agencies, it can be harder because there's more bureaucracy and there might be less focus on the bottom line because the particular department isn't controlling the budget that you might need. My experience with public agencies have been with the City of San Francisco on the accessible pedestrian signal, where we had that problem. Department of Parking and Traffic was initially the agency that dealt with accessible pedestrian signals, and that was the agency that had the fear, and there was bureaucracy, and that case took, I don't want to say a long time, but I guess I have to say a long time, and required a lot of patience. Typically, we're writing the letter to the highest, like in a city, we wrote to the city attorney. In a state department, you'd write to the top lawyer in the department. But one of the things about the ground rules document, like I said, we identify the parties. That's a good opportunity to talk about who do we really need to solve this problem. And you might need to bring in a different party. Like you might have written to one department or to, I mean, unless you're writing to the Attorney General of the whole state, which you could do, you might need to bring in other departments. Having the conversation at the ground rules level is a good place to sort out some of these things to make sure you have the right people at the table.
All right, very good. This questioner has a sort of a procedural question. When do you first say that you'll be seeking a compensatory / attorney's fees in the process to, in addition to injunctive relief? Is that part of the opening letter, or do you wait until you have that ground rules discussion?
Part of the great question. I'm sorry I didn't mention that. Part of the opening letter. Part of the opening letter. One of the reasons for that is at the end, where everybody's feeling good about things and you came up with a good solution, and people are like, wait, why are you talking about money? And oftentimes we have to say, you know, remember back to the opening letter. And one of the things I write about in the book is, you know, typically we're not having to talk about legal cases in this process. But when it comes to money, sometimes we have to say what the basis for the money claims are, either for the clients or the attorneys, and what other cases there are. And so often we say, you know, as you remember, we wrote about this in the opening letter, if you need additional resources, let me know. Because we don't want to shower someone with a bunch of legal cases, because that gets them feeling defensive. And we don't want anybody to feel defensive in this process, because when you're defensive, you're not creative. So, yeah, it's important in the opening letter to lay it out. This is a legal claim, and here's the expectation for the relief at the end of the day, in general terms, attorney's fees, client payment, as well as the supporting reasons for that. And then again at the ground rules, and then again at the end.
Okay. Another question about, you touched on this in the middle of your presentation, but do you insist that the final agreement be public?
Great question. I would say of the... I don't know. I didn't do a most recent count, but we have had a handful of agreements that are not public. I think it's really important, especially like we were talking about this class nature of it, where we're affecting a lot of people in the country. We want people to know what we're doing. We think having a public agreement is important. It builds credibility. It's transparency. It helps the community understand exactly what the obligations are. But we have had situations where we've had to give up on that. We had a company who just said, we'd never do a public agreement. We just won't do it. So in those cases, it's very important to have the press release be very clear about what's available to the community, even though they're not getting to see the actual details of the agreement. Also, you'll see if you go to the settlement page of my website, we typically break the agreements down into the public agreement and the private confidential part. And the private confidential part is the money for the clients, the money for the attorney's fees, releases, you know, the typical legal language, and the public agreement is more the injunctive relief. It's a good question. I try to insist on it, but I don't always get it.
All right. And another question, you talked a lot about you know, patients, and primarily patients from the attorney's perspective, but how do you get your clients to be patient? Immediate access.
That is a very good question. And patients, yeah, you have to be careful with that. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're waiting a year to get access. If there's some like critical, say that's a, I haven't done cases, but say there's an interpreter case at a hospital, you can't wait a long time. Patience doesn't necessarily mean a long time, but that's a really good question. And in the book, I have a checklist of working lawyers and clients working together to see if this process is the best for them. And the reason I did that checklist is because when I sent the draft of the book out, when the American Bar Association published it, they sent it to a lawyer on the East Coast who said, where does she get her clients? You know, she has to explain how to work with people. The truth is, from my work, I have learned a lot of patience from my clients who are willing to wait to make sure that accessibility is deeply rooted and, you know, understanding that it takes buy-in. But there has to be a lawyer-client conversation at the very beginning, because this process is not suited to everyone. And everyone has to agree, lawyers and clients alike, that, hey, let's try this process. This seems like a good fit. And I have stories about clients and the types of clients it might work with or not work with, but it's all about having an early conversation about that. Thanks for asking that. That's important.
And we get to one more before we get to the bottom of the hour. First, wants to know, have you ever looked at case law in the various circuits, as part of the consideration of whether or not, this type of approach will work? And for example, when you look at how the circuits have varied on the ADA application to websites, where you have some circuits saying they offer the same goods in brick and mortar, the ADA applies, and other circuits that say no, absolutely, the ADA applies to websites. Does that enter at all into the consideration?
Well, you have to understand, we did our first web case in 2000. And so our first probably 10 or 12 web cases were before this issue kind of got to anybody's attention on the circuit level or even the district court level. We write, oftentimes this is part of trust. We could say in the opening letter, there's a split in the circuits. We might say this. Split in the circuits about this. One of the things about, and I have examples of opening letters language in the book, one of the advantages of structured negotiation is we can put that aside and we don't have to spend time and resources arguing about it, because the truth is a website applies in every circuit. So that is something that the response to the letters, like Major League Baseball, we've done many cases with websites that don't have brick and mortar component. We just did the Motley Fool. We've done many cases like that. Those legal arguments are there, but those legal arguments don't, the parties agree by being in this process that they're not going to really spend time and money fighting about that.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much, Lainey, for the presentation, the overview of the structured negotiation process, and responding to the questions that our participants had. You have Lainey's contact information for folks that if you have questions in the future. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. The participants, you're the ones that drive the ADA audio conference series and the reason that it's been around so long. I want to thank Lainey, not just for the 90-plus minutes that she spent with us today, but for the time and preparing for today's session. So thank you very much for that. I want to mention that today's session will be archived and will be available within 24 hours, the audio archive of today's session, on the ADA-audio webpage. Also want to remind folks for the next month, there is a day change. Typically, the ADA audio conference is held on the third Tuesday of the month. Next month, it's going to be on Wednesday, April the 19th. So folks, be aware of that. You can get information about that session and register for that session by, again, visiting the ada-audio.org website. If you have questions, you can contact us at 877-232-1990. So again, thanks to everyone for joining us today, and thanks again to Lainey for the great presentation. Everyone, take care and good day.